Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Charles Wayne for the appellant Charles Hall. I'm here with my colleague Jamie Hoag. The two most serious counts of which Mr. Hall was convicted below were bank fraud and conspiracy to commit money laundering. But there was a failure of proof on the part of the government as to both of those counts. Starting with bank fraud, the government was required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the two allegedly defrauded institutions were federally insured, but the government did not do so. With regard to those two institutions, there was no proof that either was insured. Each was a subsidiary of a different institution that the government said was insured. But that's not true either.
Initially, one of them was a wholly owned subsidiary, wasn't it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Isn't there a document in the record showing that one of them was a 100% owned operating subsidiary?
Correct.
And as to that one, how could there not be custody or control by the parent of the assets of the subsidiary?
Because under the test, it's not merely custody and control, and that is what the language of the statute, but the test, and the government agrees with this, is that one set forth in two First Circuit cases, the Edelkind and Walsh cases. And it's not enough to say that there's one, that the subsidiary is 100% owned by the parent. Rather, the issue is whether there's a sufficient factual nexus between the parent, the insured parent, assuming insurance, and the uninsured subsidiary with respect to the transaction in issue, so that the parent itself is a victim of the fraud. It's a fact-intensive inquiry, and it's not just a question of the 100% stock ownership. That only begins the inquiry. That does not end the inquiry.
give me the standard again.
It is there sufficient factual nexus between the insured parent and the uninsured subsidiary.
What greater factual nexus could there be than that the insured bank's asset is diminished in value by the loss?
Because the more is required. For example, the factors that the First Circuit found persuasive in the Edelkind case were the following. The subsidiary used the parent's forms and guidelines. An official of the parent approved the loan. The subsidiary transferred the loan to the parent after closing.
Well, that was all true there, but there's nothing to tells me that it was essential.
It is true, and the Edelkind case says this, that neither the statute nor the case law instructs us on how tight the factual nexus needs to be. But in this case, that issue is easy to resolve because there was, as to either of the pair of parents and subsidiaries, there was absolutely no proof that there was any sort of factual nexus of the type required.
Well, wait a minute, of the type present in the Edelkind case. But as to what's required, all we need, according to the statute, is custody or control.
That is true. I would say, though, that there's absolutely no evidence. What the Edelkind and Walsh cases say is that the parent must be sufficiently involved in the transaction so that the parent stands in the victim's shoes as does the subsidiary.
Well,
there's
no proof of that here. Who decided those
cases? I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Who decided those cases?
Well, the First Circuit, Your Honor. And we are in the D.C. Circuit, but I would note that this seems to be the prevailing law at the moment, and the government agrees that that's the test. And the difference is the government says that there was proof, but there is no proof. Let me take the first parent subsidiary pair, which is the Guaranty Bank of Austin, Texas is the parent, and Guaranty Residential Lending is the subsidiary. Okay. There was a failure of proof here as to the parent. There is absolutely no proof that the parent, Guaranty Bank of Austin, Texas, was federally insured during the relevant time period. The relevant time period is April 2002 until May of 2003. Okay. The only evidence in the record that was put in was that the Guaranty Bank of Austin, Texas, was insured on February 14, 2005 and no earlier. And that's Appendix 68, one of the government's exhibits. And 69 as well. So with regard to the Guaranty Bank group or parent sub situation, there's no proof as to the parent. So what we're left with is in an application of this test, which, as I say, the government agrees is the test. The other defrauded institution was a subsidiary called National City Mortgage Company, and the parent was National City Bank of Indiana. There is no National City Bank of Indiana. There was proof that it was insured during the relevant time period. But there's absolutely no proof that the subsidiary was. There's only the only proof in the record, it says that the, and this is Appendix 70, says that the only is that the insurance applies to any U.S. domestic branch office of the parent bank. There's another exhibit, actually the same exhibit, also at Appendix 70, which says that the status of the subsidiary is that of an, quote, an operating subsidiary. So even within the own proof, it doesn't, there's no, absolutely no proof that this subsidiary is a branch office, and I would say that it's pretty plain just looking at the words that it's not. But moreover, there's absolutely no proof that the parent had any involvement in the transaction, and that's what's required under the Edelkind-Walsh analysis.
I thought I understood you to say that the government doesn't contest that that's required.
The government does not contest that insurance is required.
No, I'm sorry. Okay.
The government does not contest. The government accepts the fact, and they cite the Edelkind-Walsh case in their brief.
As I had recalled, and now I think I've confirmed, their position is that if it was a, if it as appears it was a subsidiary of the bank, then that is sufficient. Right, that the loss to the subsidiary is a loss to the bank.
That is the government's position.
Okay.
Now, how they get there is to say, and this is a secondary argument that the makes, they want the court to look at cases decided under 18 U.S.C. Section 657, which is an anti-embezzlement statute, and the institutions affected are those insured by the FSLIC. There's one case, the Cartwright case from the Fifth Circuit in 1978, which appears, when you read it, to state a per se rule, saying that it's in the language. First of all, the language is different in the statute. It's not custody or control. It's do the assets, quote, belong to the insured parent. That's the language in 657. What the government says is
that would seem to require a tighter connection, wouldn't it?
Well, that's not the way. Well, I would agree.
I could have custody or control over something I don't own.
I would say this, that both under 657, its companion statute 656, and 1344, all of the cases engage in a fact-intensive analysis about the relationship between the parent and the sub and the parent's role, if any, in the transaction. That is clear. What the government argues is the Cartwright case, as I said, creates a per se rule. So the government wants to say that as long as there's a wholly owned subsidiary, that fact, without more, is enough. That simply isn't true. It's not true even in the 11th Circuit, which, of course, Cartwright is a binding precedent. There's a later case in the 11th Circuit, Prater, which we cite to the court, which says that this notion that Cartwright sets forth a per se rule is, quote, overstated, unquote. So as we set forth in our brief, if you look at, as I said, the 18 U.S.C. 657 cases, the Section 656 cases, all of them engage in a fact-intensive analysis, and it's simply not enough to say that it's a wholly owned sub. Even under, as I say, the government's view of Cartwright has been rejected by the 11th Circuit. So for all those reasons, the government failed to prove an essential element of bank fraud, which of course they agree, which is, and it's jurisdictional, that in fact that the institution defrauded must have federal insurance. And they simply didn't do so. The second serious offense of which Mr. Hall was convicted was conspiracy to commit money laundering. Now, they charged him with conspiracy to commit money laundering, but not the substantive money laundering offense. Nevertheless, the government tried to prove both at trial, and we would say failed us to both, because the intended future conduct identified in the indictment and proved at trial did not constitute money laundering as a matter of law. And because the object of the conspiracy did not constitute money laundering, then the conspiracy charge had to fail as well. Now, whether money laundering is charged under the so-called concealment of proceeds section, 1956A1B1, or the intent to promote the carrying on of an unspecified unlawful activity under 1956A1A1, or even under section 1957, the companion money laundering statute, it is fundamental, and I would say that it's universally recognized that the money laundering conduct must be separate and distinct from the underlying offense that generated the money to be laundered. And the Supreme Court has said so. We cite the court to the Cabrales case, where the court says that money laundering statutes do not proscribe the anterior criminal conduct that yielded the funds. In the more recent Santos case, the court dealt with this issue of what it called merger, and it's talking about the same thing, that is an overlap in proof between the substantive offense and money laundering, and spoke, and this is important, talked about how an expense of the underlying fraud cannot be money laundering, and that's what we have here. This court, a couple of years ago in the Adefahinti case, talked about how the conduct that constitutes money laundering cannot be an integral part of the underlying fraud. So, and as again, the government recognizes it. So the U.S. Attorney's Manual deals with it. This very U.S. Attorney's Office in 2003 agreed to a post-verdict entry of judgment because the underlying activity was not distinct from the money laundering transactions. And here they were not distinct. The government charged money laundering in this way. It focused on three of the properties in issue, and the same conduct is to each. Allegedly, Mr. Hall got settlement proceeds from a settlement agent, a co-conspirator. He deposited this money in his own account, got enough cash back to purchase a cashier's check to pay the so-called borrower's proceeds, that is the cash down payment required of the person that was buying the house.
Meanwhile, the settlement was on hold while this happened?
Correct.
How long would it take?
It wasn't on hold, but allegedly the co-conspirator was waiting for Mr. Hall to return with the cashier's check.
Sometime that same day?
Yes, absolutely. Shortly thereafter. He came back, gave her the check. Okay, that's what allegedly is money laundering. But that is not money laundering because that final act of obtaining sufficient cash to pay these down payment monies, it's called in the record, or the cash from the borrower, as it's called in the record, was the final act of the underlying fraud. And the government concedes that. The government says in its brief that it was important to the lender, and this is the government's brief at page 24, note 14. It was important to the lender that the property purchaser have a personal financial stake in the property to diminish the risk of foreclosure. Okay. So in other words, Mr. Hall, again allegedly, had to come up with that money in the form of a cashier's check or cash. The government also says on the same page at note 15, the borrowers were not allowed to use personal checks at the closing, but rather needed guaranteed funds such as certified checks, bank checks, or money orders. So when Mr. Hall got that check at the settlement, it was designated as construction rehab, and then he put it in his own bank account, got enough money to pay the cash from the borrower, that's part and parcel of the underlying fraud. It has nothing to do with money laundering. Now, the government never alleged that Mr. Hall took the remaining construction rehab money and engaged in conduct that constituted money laundering. Maybe they could have done so, but they did not. Now, Mr. Hall, so this conduct did not constitute money laundering, and in addition, as I said before, he was charged with conspiring to commit money laundering, not the substantive offense, but because the object of the conspiracy.
My colleagues have questions on this allegation of error. I wanted to ask you something about the evidentiary argument.
Absolutely.
What the government refers to as a hearsay ruling, I don't think the judge told us why he was excluding the evidence, but assuming for purposes of this discussion that the judge did err in excluding the statements by the attorney, the advice of counsel statements, how prejudicial is that to your client? He got the evidence in through his own testimony, and there was no attempt made to offer other direct to corroborate. So was the exclusion of that cross-examination prejudicial?
Well, we believe it was because he was denied valuable corroborative evidence. It is true that he himself testified.
And so far as we can tell from the record, he could have called these witnesses back to ask them on direct. We don't know whether the judge would have admitted it or not. Had he called them back as his witnesses?
The judge, as you point out, did not give a basis for his ruling.
He didn't say why he ruled that.
But I think the judge was clear, and it's clear on the record, that he was not going to permit that testimony.
Wasn't it permitted as cross?
It was rather
at the fringe of what was covered on direct, and maybe he erred in not letting it in on cross, but there was no proffer made of that evidence as direct evidence to corroborate your client's testimony.
That is correct, and I do not fault the defense lawyer below for not making such a proffer.
I don't either. I'm not faulting him. I'm simply questioning whether there really was enough help in that corroboration for us to grant relief on appeal.
That's a fair question. I mean, we certainly state in the brief that it did affect substantial rights, even if it does not.
You have an excellent argument that was erroneous. I'm not questioning your argument that the judge made error. I will question the government about that. That'll come up in a few minutes. But as far as prejudice, I'm not sure that I find it there.
I would say this, that Mr. Hall's defense was that he lacked the specific intent mm-hmm. to commit these crimes. This evidence goes right to that defense. It's the heart of the defense. So, yes, he was able to testify himself that he lacked the specific intent because he believed, because the lawyer told him, that everything was legal.
Did the government question whether his lawyer had told him that?
Did not. In fact, the government, I would say this, and we have this in the brief, the government opened the door to this whole line of questioning by stating an opening statement.
But they did not contend, they really didn't contest his testimony, did they?
They did not. That is correct.
In that regard. So I'm not sure how prejudicial that lack of corroboration is. I'm not saying it isn't. At this point, I'm just questioning.
And I understand Your Honor's point. I would say that because it's at the heart of his defense, that's why that it does reach the lever under the Katiakos case, that it affected substantial rights and that the conviction, all the convictions need to be reversed for that reason.
Okay, unless my colleagues have further questions, your time is up, but we'll give you back a couple of minutes.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. Catherine Kelly on behalf of the United States.
Why isn't counsel correct that there has to be an independence in the money laundering, an independent act separate from the underlying scheme?
There does have to be an independent act.
And what's the independent act in this case?
The independent, what's getting confusing to everybody in this case, I think, is the fact that there was one settlement that occurred here. But our
That's
point.
Not confusing.
Our
That's
point
not
is,
confusing. Okay. That's simply a fact.
Well,
and
then,
what I'm asking you is, what is it in the transactions that is money laundering that is separate from the underlying crime?
The underlying crime, first of all, is bank fraud, which occurred as soon as the money was disgorged from the financial institution, from the lender. Under Christo, it says that bank fraud is complete at the execution. That is when money is moved out of the financial institution, which happened in this case when the money was wired from the lender to the settlement company before the settlement even took place. Then, so the bank fraud at that point, the underlying bank fraud is complete. The second transaction, the laundering transaction,
wouldn't have been a very successful fraud if at that point the perpetrators had just stopped.
Right.
But the point is all the false statements.
It would have just been a theft.
They wouldn't have been successful in taking the money and running with it, certainly.
Right.
But they would have been successful in defrauding the bank in that they were able to disgorge money from the bank.
Doesn't fraud have an element other than a theft, an element of concealment or of misleadingness?
Well, here it was charged as promotional money laundering.
Mm-hmm.
So our point was they got the money, they took it at that point and used a portion of it to come back and buy cashier's checks, which they brought back to settlement. However,
it looks like all one scheme, and wasn't it alleged as all one scheme?
It was alleged as promotional money laundering, but the laundering offense was alleged to be going and taking a portion of the proceeds that were obtained through the underlying bank fraud that was complete at that point, and then going through and laundering that money by buying cashier's checks to make it look like the straw buyers had brought down payment money to the settlement.
Looking at count one, the fraud conspiracy, wasn't the conduct that you're referring to alleged as part of the fraud conspiracy?
The count one is a different conspiracy. That's conspiracy to commit bank fraud and conspiracy to commit wire fraud.
And I'm asking you, in that conspiracy, didn't you allege that same conduct?
That was part of the bank fraud, conspiracy to commit bank fraud was making the false statements on the loan applications themselves. For instance,
sometimes settlement, co-conspirator Vicki A. Robinson signed checks worth approximately X dollars for co-conspirator Eleanor Davis.
Well, that was part of the bank fraud.
Part of the original conspiracy, the bank fraud conspiracy.
It's different in that if there's still bank fraud, when Vicki Robinson got that money, first of all, the bank fraud is complete because the money has been taken from the lender.
What happened next that isn't in the conspiracy to commit bank fraud?
Well, What happened?
That constituted a money laundering.
What happened next was that when the defendant or others got that money from Vicki Robinson, they then took a portion of that money and went and bought cashier's checks to make it look like the straw buyers had brought down payment money to the settlement, which in fact did not happen.
But wasn't that charged in counts one and two as part of, counts one, two, and so forth before you get to the money laundering as part of the fraud conduct?
It was explaining what happened, but our point is, and as Christo makes clear, the actual bank fraud is completed at the execution when the money is moved out of the financial institution. So even though to make the settlement look kosher to the lenders in this case, they brought back that cashier's check to make it look like the
store. What would have happened if they hadn't done that?
Would it happen?
Would the bank just have gone its merry way and been out the money, or would they realize something was wrong?
They would have realized something was wrong in that transaction.
So it's still part of the original conduct, isn't it? It's not really separate and distinct from the underlying crime.
The underlying crime is bank fraud, which was undertaken in this case by submitting false appraisals to the mortgage lenders, by telling the lenders, for instance, that the straw buyers were going to live in these properties, which wasn't true, and making a number, false statements about their income levels and so forth, in order to convince the lender to
and in order to make
pay
that
out
work,
the mortgage
they
money.
Went through the settlement process that you're charging as a separate crime of money laundering.
No, they right? I'm not charging that the settlement is a separate crime of money laundering. That the settlement is how ultimately payment of the bank loan money gets paid out. The money laundering that occurred here is not the payment of that money, but it's when Mr. Hall or others went to a bank, bought with that money a cashier's check, and then brought that cashier's check back to the settlement company to make it look like straw buyers had put in a down payment.
It sounds an awful lot like part of the original scheme, doesn't it?
It's not part. The point is that the bank, the underlying bank fraud, had already been committed and completed at that point. And as other case law shows us, particularly the Misla Alvarado case that we cited in our brief, it's okay to have both these things happening at or near or happening at the same time. That's not the important factor. And the fact that there's one settlement transaction where a loan ultimately is closed does not mean that you don't, in that situation, have the money from the bank being wired to the settlement company, thus completing the underlying bank fraud. And then the separate transaction, again, is when they took a portion of that money and went to the bank and bought a cashier's check to make it look like that settlement was kosher, which ultimately promoted
make
the entire
like
scheme.
That settlement was kosher.
Right, which
didn't
promoted the entire scheme.
Did you say the settlement was part of the underlying fraud?
No, the settlement is not part, of,
not
the
part of the underlying fraud. Fraud.
The settlement is not part of the underlying fraud.
How far would they have gotten if they had quit with the money coming out of the bank and not gone through the rest of this?
They may have gotten away with that one deal.
Maybe.
And they may have had to be on the
slim
land from there on
they
on.
Gotten away with that one deal.
But there would not have been any future. There would not have been any future transactions. And this is clearly.
Was there consecutive time sentenced on this underlying money fraud, on this money laundering as opposed to the fraud in the final judgment?
No, in the final judgment, the two bank fraud counts and the money laundering count were all concurrent.
Why are you up here defending this?
Because he's A, very guilty, and B, there's absolutely
he's
two
no more
transactions.
Guilty with or without. You get your pound of flesh. You don't have to get 18 ounces. I'm not sure what it is the government.
He committed money laundering conspiracy in this case.
Well, your U.S. Attorney's Manual says you've got to have separate conduct.
Which is exactly what happened here.
You can get up here and actually make a straight face argument, perhaps, that it's separate conduct, but you've got to know this is very close to that edge. And I'm really wondering why a U.S. Attorney's Office is devoting assets to defending that count.
Because it is.
I know why you put it in there, because at that time you're still open to bargain pleas, but I really am wondering why the U.S. Attorney's Office is making such a point of it.
Because there is separate conduct
to the edge
here.
As this is.
I mean, for instance, the Adefahinti case that defense counsel cited, that was a situation where they simply got money from the bank and then put it into different accounts. They didn't do anything after getting that loan money, which would be akin to Mr. Hall here taking the mortgage money and running. He didn't do anything with that after that in Adefahinti, and that, for that reason, is why there wasn't a money laundering. Same case in, for instance, Singh, why there was money laundering. You had prostitutes who were using the money they got from their first transaction of the day to rent a hotel room for the rest of the day.
Let me ask you about the evidentiary argument. You can't tell from the record why the judge excluded this evidence, right?
It's not entirely clear, but the point would be that between the time the judge made the ruling and the time that was first mentioned, the government did file a motion explaining that you shouldn't be allowed to use statements of co-conspirators
for the benefit of the defendant. That statement of co-conspirator has nothing to do with this case that I can see. You cite a section of 801, a subsection that has to do with statements of co-conspirators, that is a rule of inclusion rather than exclusion, and it deals with hearsay, and this is not hearsay.
Well, even if it's
this
not
is
hearsay,
not offered for the proof of the matter asserted therein, now is it, counsel?
In further looking at it, I don't believe it is.
Right. You have to agree this is not hearsay.
Right. But I think the point
on what basis, then, is it excludable?
It was excluded in
801D has nothing to do with this. That's a rule of inclusion, not a rule of exclusion, mm-hmm. and it's a rule dealing with hearsay, and this is not hearsay.
Well, even
so
if it's
what basis did the judge have for keeping this out?
He may not have had a valid basis for keeping it out, mm-hmm. however, except that when you get into it, it's really irrelevant, and you could be kept out on
irrelevant.
That event.
It's not irrelevant. It would be corroborative of the defense.
In only a very, very minor way. All that you get from that, at the very most, is that, well, maybe if Mr. Sliffman told these other people that it was legal, maybe he also told that to the defendant.
That's all you get. Which is definitely corroborative.
But when you look at the Sixth Amendment and you look at whether or not that was an abuse of discretion, the question is, did the defendant have a meaningful opportunity to prevent a complete defense under the Sixth Amendment? And here, he still got to put on his own defense. He said that Sliffman and even Ms. Robinson told him what they were doing was perfectly legal.
Looking at this, perhaps the style of our former Chief Judge Harry Edwards, I'm going to say to you, shouldn't your argument be he could have excluded it since it was only corroborative, since the direct evidence it was designed to corroborate had not come in yet?
That's correct.
Okay.
It hadn't come in yet because Mr. Hall hadn't testified yet. And I think also it's very irrelevant, and it has very little corroborative value because you have to look at it in the whole context. And here you have the co-conspirators saying, essentially, regardless of what Mr. Sliffman may or may not have told them about the illegality, they all said at the time of trial that they knew when they were doing this that they were doing something illegal. So you have it in that context. You also have it in the context of Mr. Hall saying that, yeah, Mr. Sliffman told me it was legal. So he got that defense out. He also got to say that no one else who reviewed the loans told him that he was doing anything wrong. You also had corroboration from the co-conspirators that Mr. Sliffman was intimately involved in the settlements and had been questioned, particularly by Mr. Davis, about its legality. So that was all in the record. So ultimately, there's just no prejudice that would cause any reversible error in this case. And I'd like to turn back to the FDIC issue, if I may.
Please.
The point the government is making here is not that we agree with any sort of test that's been set forth in Edelkind or Walsh. Walsh and Edelkind both make very clear that they don't define any sort of test. Walsh, particularly in its last sentence, declined to set forth any general rule as to what is necessary to show the nexus with the federally insured institution. And again, Edelkind made the point that there's no statute or case law that sets how close that nexus must be. So we don't agree, as the defense counsel was saying, that there's a test that has failed to be met, set forth in either Walsh or Edelkind. And we would rely on the Kehoe case, the Cartwright case, and the White case to say the loss to the subsidiary is, in fact, a loss to the banks, the federally insured institutions themselves. And we're not relying on those because we are saying that the statutes involved in those cases are absolutely akin to 1344. But the point that they made in Cartwright, which was not assailed in the Prater decision, was that Cartwright was saying that it's hard to assail the argument that depleting the assets of a wholly owned subsidiary that reduces that subsidiary's stock value doesn't then have an effect on the parent's assets as well.
We don't know that one of these two subsidiaries was wholly owned, do we?
We don't know that NCM was wholly owned based on what was put in the record, but we do know that it had been an operating subsidiary of National City Bank of Indiana since 1998.
Well, would it matter if it's owned only in part or even a minority?
I don't believe it would matter if it was owned only in part, because you still have the situation where if you're going to deplete the value of the subsidiary's assets, you're ultimately going to affect the value or create a loss to the parent.
What is your answer to Mr. Wayne's point about the showing that the bank was insured at the relevant time?
Well, first of all, I'd say that the court shouldn't address that because it was first brought up in the reply brief by the defendant. But if the court does, this court has already decided in a case, and I'll give you the cite because the name is horrifically long, but it's 39 F3rd 1205. It was a D.C. Circuit case in 1994, United States versus Nanyarugo, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and ultimately said that the government may rely on present or post or proof of insurance after an offense to go back and make a reasonable inference that the institution was federally insured at the time of the offenses. And here we had Agent Gordon from the FBI who was testifying, looking at documents, saying that Guarantee Bank was in fact federally insured. And notably, one of the documents actually, for whatever reason, was not entered into evidence, but he was looking at it at the time. It actually did show that Guarantee Bank was insured from, I believe it's incorporation in 1989 all the way through 2005.
Well, as you said, it's not in the record.
It was presented to Agent Gordon, and he was looking at that document when he was saying that Guarantee Bank was insured. It may have just been a complete glitch that document wasn't.
And when did you say this argument was first raised?
I'm sorry, Your Honor,
You said the argument was not raised until when?
Well, this argument about the timing of the insurance being incorrect was not raised until the defense counsel filed its reply brief. So for that reason, since it's a new argument in reply, we would ask the court not to reach
it. I understand that ordinarily arguments raised in reply are not considered, but isn't this jurisdictional in nature?
Well, it may, yeah, you're right, Your Honor,
that's
fine.
So it could be considered, even though if it's raised today, it could be considered, couldn't it?
I guess for that reason, it could be raised and it could be considered. But and if the court is going to consider it, we would refer you to the Nanyarugo decision, which...
And I don't blame you for not trying to pronounce that.
Yeah, it's a long one. So that's where we are. The case law that the defense counsel cites saying that antecedent proof of insurance doesn't prove insurance at the time of the offense is the opposite situation. And it's trumped by case law of the circuit. So if the court has no further questions, I'd respectfully request that you affirm the judgment.
Why does the insured status of the bank go to the jurisdiction of the court?
Well, because the jurisdiction of a federal offense having exposed the federally insured institution to a risk of loss.
It's an element in the offense.
It's an element of the offense, and it's a jurisdictional matter.
It's what makes it a federal offense. When I was prosecuting, if somebody robbed the Bank of Kannapolis, we couldn't prosecute them because it wasn't federally insured. But if they robbed any other bank in the area, we could prosecute them because they were federally insured.
Sorry, it's both jurisdictional and an element of the offense. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Wayne.
Judge Sentelle, to your point about the corroborative nature of the evidence and that the trial judge could have excluded it as corroborative, and your point about how those witnesses could have been called in the defense's case, I would say that that is a terrific burden to put on the defense counsel below, and that evidence could have come in subject to being tied up later.
It could have, but could have and must have are not quite the same thing. When you're offering something to corroborate evidence that isn't there yet, is a judge abusing his discretion to say, well, counsel, I'm not going to let the jury hear that until I'm sure there's something to corroborate? And in a criminal case, that's a question that's very hard to ask, where the witness they're going to corroborate is the defendant, and he can choose up till the last second not to take that stand. So is a judge really abusing his discretion? I grant you, he should have told us why he left the evidence out, but wasn't that a possible basis for excluding that evidence?
That would be a possible basis. I would say, though, that because the government opened the door in its opening statement, that I don't think the government had standing to make such an objection. With regard to the bank fraud and the requirement of federal insurance, there's no evidence in the record here that the subsidiaries were insured. What the government is asking is for a per se rule that always and under all circumstances, a wholly owned subsidiary that has been defrauded, that automatically means that the parent has been defrauded, where the parent is insured. that just isn't, that has been rejected by the only court that the government can cite where that actually happened, and that's the Cartwright case. As I said in the Prater case, the 11th Circuit later said that it's not a per se rule and that we have to look at the facts. And if the court has no further questions, I see I'm...
Where was Cartwright decided? Fifth Circuit.
Fifth Circuit, 1978.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the Prater case is 11th Circuit. Thank you.
Mr. Wayne, I believe you were appointed to represent the defendant appellant in this case, and the court wants to thank you for your service to the defendant, to the court, and to the court system. Thank you very much.